Stories told of a pastor who served in California in a beach town community, and he would routinely go to the beach to have his devotions. And on this particular morning, he was having an incredible time. And in the middle of his prayer, he simply said, "God, would you grant me a wish?" And suddenly out of nowhere, a booming voice said, "You have been a faithful servant. I will give you one wish." He said, "Well, God, you know that I fear driving and air flying. And so would you be willing to build a bridge from California to Hawaii?" God said, "That's a materialistic gift. That's terrible. Of course I could do it, but why would I waste the time and energy? Choose something else." For a moment he thought, and he said, "Well then, Lord, would you help me understand my wife? Why she cries, why she says nothing when it's clearly something? How to know what that look means?" A pause, and he said, "Was that a two-lane or a four-lane?" We laugh, but the reality is that one of the most difficult chores we have is understanding the one God has given us to live with. I'm convinced that Moses in Genesis chapter 2 has it perfectly right, that when Adam was given Eve, Eve was someone exactly like him, only completely different. And trying to figure out those differences is a huge part of marriage. This summer, I've had the incredible privilege of walking with four couples in their preparation for their marriage, to go through the premarital counseling and to try and help them to understand that differences aren't bad. In fact, the differences are what make us better together than alone, even though they oftentimes frustrate us. But one of the things I really wish I could do is, let's go to the scriptures and I will show you a wonderful marriage. If you think about it a little bit, that's a harder chore than you think. As you come to the New Testament, obviously the primary figure of both the New and the Old Testament is Christ. And Jesus will have much to say about marriage, but he himself never married. And the most prolific of the writers, the Apostle Paul, will in Ephesians, in Colossians, in Corinthians, he'll have much to say about marriage, but we're specifically told he didn't marry. But in chapter 9, he gives us this insight. He's saying, "I had a right to get married, but I chose not to choose a believing wife, as did all the other apostles." The Lord's brother and Cephas or Peter. In fact, we know Peter was married because we're introduced to Peter's mother-in-law back in the Gospels. But the reality is, we know more about his mother-in-law than his wife. We know nothing about any of these women. And really, the only marriage you get a glimpse at in the New Testament is Aquila and Priscilla. And all we know about them is they served alongside of Paul. So let's go back to the Old Testament. Clearly, there's lots of great marriages in the Old Testament, right? Abraham and Sarah, the founders of the faith. When infertility was a struggle, Sarah says to Abraham, "Why don't you sleep with my Egyptian slave girl?" And when she does conceive, suddenly she hates Hagar and Ishmael. Jacob, I don't think there could be any better poster boy for the problems of polygamy than the bitterness and hatred that you found in Jacob. David, his most famous marriage came about because he committed adultery and then murdered the husband. The reality is there really aren't that many great marriages. So where do you go? Maybe the best place to go is to that uncomfortable book called The Song of Solomon. This morning, as we're making our way through the 66 books of the Bible, we have begun back at the beginning of the year in those five books that Moses wrote. We began in the beginning, and we've watched as God established his people. We then took a time to go through all of the books of history, and we walked with Joshua all the way up until the exile, and then through the exile to the post-exilic time. Next Sunday, we're going to jump into some pretty tough material. We're going to go to the book of Isaiah and then to Jeremiah. And as God lifts up these men of God who largely condemn the world around them, we're going to listen to the prophets. But this morning, we're concluding our look at these five books that are oftentimes called poetry. I would suggest that maybe they would be better called wisdom literature, as they share with us how to live. If you were here a couple weeks ago, we were in the book of Job. And in Job, I would suggest we're given insight on how to live when life stinks. Job's life had everything taken from him. His family, his material possessions, his health. And yet, even in the midst of all of that, he continued. We then move to Psalms. My guess is that that is many of our favorite books. It is that incredible understanding of how do we live with God when we're happy and when we're sad. When God seems vibrant and real and when he seems distant and silent. There's a psalm for that. We then move to the book of Proverbs, and in the book of Proverbs, we really figure out how to live with each other. The wisest man who's ever lived gives us these little nuggets, these little two-line statements on how we should live with money, with friends, in marriage. And then last week, if you were out at camp with us, maybe the most depressing of all the books in the Old Testament, maybe in all of the Bible, as the wisest man who's ever lived tries to find meaning in life under the sun. And his conclusion is, I've tried everything. I've tried women, I've tried wine, I've tried possessions, I've tried popularity, I've tried everything. And it's all meaningless. It's empty, it's fleeting, it's frustrating. And then he concludes, the only way to find meaning in this life is to recognize that this life isn't all there is. Amen. That we have an eternity with an incredible God who seeks a relationship not just in eternity, but with us today. And this morning, we conclude the wisdom literature, we conclude Solomon's writing by going to, in honesty, maybe the most difficult book I will get the chance to speak from as a pastor. I thought about asking how many of you have ever heard a sermon on the Song of Solomon. In fact, the reason I had Paul come up and talk is I was hoping he'd take longer so I wouldn't have to talk so long. But the book of Song of Solomon, if I can just begin by looking at it, who wrote it? Well, there's been recently some discussion, but the book begins with a statement. It's Solomon's Song of Songs. Normally we call it the Song of Solomon, but really the actual title is Song of Songs. It speaks of this is Solomon's greatest song he's ever written. But wait a second. This is going to be a song about marriage love? From a guy with 1,000 wives? Really? In fact, one of the main reasons why people want to find somebody else, in fact, some will go as far to say that it doesn't really say it's Solomon's Song of Songs, it's a Song of Songs written for Solomon. Because clearly a guy with 1,000 wives doesn't know what he's talking about. Well, the good news is, as you go forward, you will find, it's not chapter 1, I believe it's chapter 6, where you'll find he only had 140 wives at this point. He just had 60 queens and 80 concubines. Now, you have to remember that in his day, oftentimes a wedding was a political alliance. It was one kingdom giving a daughter of the king to marry another so that there would be no war between the two. Some have tried to argue that most of his marriages were just marriages that were political alliances. I don't know. And I honestly don't know how to rectify it. But I think you have to work really hard to suggest that it wasn't Solomon who wrote it. And Solomon writes it about what? Well, the answer is love. The problem with that is, in English, love can mean anything from I love ice cream to I love my wife. Love is one of those words that is incredibly elastic. It doesn't really mean much. But I think most of you realize that as you come to the New Testament, particularly in the Greek, there's actually four words. C.S. Lewis is maybe best known for his Chronicles of Narnia, but he actually was a scholar. He taught at Oxford most of his life, and his expertise was middle and ancient literature, and his favorite subject in those middle and ancient literature was love. He spent his life trying to figure out what exactly was meant by love in all of these different languages. In 1958, he on the radio for the BBC, put together a series of lectures on what he called were the five loves of the New Testament. He begins with the first one. It's storge. It's not probably a word that you're tremendously familiar with. It's a word that primarily means affection. It's most often used in a family context. That's my family. We love each other. We storge each other. Interestingly enough, in the New Testament, the vast majority of the times it's used in the negative. About the only time it's not used in the negative is when it's combined with a second word, phileo, and you get the idea of this brotherly affection, which brings us to the second one. And the second one is one that, if you remember back in your elementary high school, elementary history days, they told you that the city of Philadelphia was what? The city of brotherly love. Now, I don't know if it is that today, but that was why they chose the name. And Philadelphia is one of the more common words in the New Testament. It speaks of that that's friendship. I find it kind of interesting that C.S. Lewis will go out on a limb and suggest that you can't have friendship between different genders, because that friendship, if not controlled, always ends up in erotic love. I don't know if he's right or not. But the reality is there are many opportunities for you to experience and enjoy this friendship, this phileo love. And the most common, the most important is agape. And that is the sacrificial love. It is, for God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him doesn't have to perish but can have everlasting life. It is this incredible sacrifice that God has in Jesus, but it's also the love that we are called to have for one another. In John is going to make the point that it's easy to say you love. Let's see your love. God gave his Son, his life of his Son. What are you willing to give for the person sitting next to you? But then we come to this word that we get our English word erotic from. And it is primarily the physical aspect of love. I do find it really interesting that C.S. Lewis paints this interesting picture that in the first century there was actually two kinds of physical love. There was one that he would call the Venus love. It was around the worship of the goddess Venus. And the whole point of that love was, I need to find a way to pleasure myself. It's all about what's in it for me. And he goes as far to say that when you say there's this lust-filled man out on the prowl looking for a woman, he's not looking for a woman. The woman simply becomes the instrument, the tool he needs to satisfy his own desires. And the illustration C.S. Lewis uses is, a man who smokes doesn't keep the carton of smokes when he's done. He discards it. And when that is your entire role, is that this physical love that all of us crave is about me, we just throw away the ones we're done with. Erotic love is the same result in many ways, but it's not my enjoyment I'm seeking. But I'm seeking a way to fulfill the needs of the one I love. I focus on the other, not myself. Erotic love is the very kind of love we come to when we open the book of Song of Solomon. And so how do we interpret it? Well, the reality is, down through the ages, the whole idea of erotic love has scared the Jews and the Christians. And so what has happened so often is that there's this conclusion, it can't possibly be what it says. It can't really mean that. So it must mean something deeper. And to be fair, there are allegories in the Bible. Jesus will use parables. Parables are a form of allegory where he tells a story where the real meaning of the story isn't found in the story. The prodigal son, it isn't so much about the details of how much wealth did the dad have, when did he let him go. No. The point was, God loves when those who are lost are found. And so it does happen. But the Jews came to the conclusion that this can't possibly be what it sounds like it says. And so it's actually an allegory for the love of God for Israel. In fact, it's interesting, every Passover, the Song of Solomon is read. What in the world does Passover have to do with the Song of Solomon? Well, the thinking goes something like this. God's love for Israel began at the Passover. He paid an incredible price and brought them out of Egypt. The Song of Solomon continues that love journey as we watch, as it's not really about Solomon and a bride. It's about the Father and Israel. And so they read the Song of Solomon often. The church came to much the same conclusion. In fact, many of the early church fathers concluded that you were not allowed to read the book of Song of Solomon until you were at least 30 years of age. That it was result, and the idea was not the allegory of the Father and Israel, but rather Jesus and the church. And to be fair, there is this analogy that Paul will use often. One of his favorite illustrations of the church is the bride. And he will say in Ephesians 5 that marriage reflects our relationship with Christ. But the problem with the allegory is that, where do you stop? You can go back and read some of the most bizarre applications. The Jews would say the two breasts speak of Moses and Aaron. Church fathers said that the navel filled with mixed wine is actually communion. That the kisses are expressions of God's love. That the darkened bride in chapter 1 is the church filled with sin as God sets her free. I think you get caught up and you can get lost in a big hurry. In fact, if you grew up in the church, you may have sung the song, "His banner over me is love. Jesus is the vine and we are the branches. His banner over me is love." Do you know where that verse comes from? It comes from Song of Solomon. And the person who wrote the song concluded that it's not Solomon and his bride, it's Jesus and the church. As you go through the Old and the New Testament, I would suggest that while there are allegories, they are almost always told to us to be a parable, to be an allegory. Just simply taking a story that I can't quite get my hands around and make it an allegory is incredibly dangerous. And secondly, should it surprise you God talks about erotic love? I'm as guilty as anyone, so this is probably speaking to me more, but my guess is you've been to a wedding where a pastor has read this verse or spoken on this verse. "For this reason, a man will leave his father and his mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh." And we go off about leaving and cleaving and weaving and all of those wonderful things, and then we pretend like the passage ends there. It doesn't. When was the last time you heard an entire message on Genesis chapter 2, verse 25? The man and his wife were
naked.
I can't say that word in public. I'll be honest, I don't get how God could have put Adam and Eve in the garden, and it would seem, if his intention was that humanity would never wear clothing. I don't understand how that possibly could work. And yet, that's what you read. And they were naked, and they felt no shame. A God who created the physical aspects of love shouldn't be terribly surprised if he decides to leave an entire book on the very subject. The book, as with most of Solomon's books, becomes a difficult book to outline, but I thought it was interesting. This is just for your FYI. If you were here 2 weeks ago when we were looking at the book of Proverbs, I suggested that the story of Aladdin may very well have its roots in Solomon receiving 3 wishes from God. Many have gone to great lengths and suggested that the book of Song of Solomon is actually the story of Cinderella. That as you open it up, there's this little servant girl working away in the fields, and she's only there because her brothers are abusing her and forcing her to do their work as well as hers. And then along comes this shepherd dressed as a commoner. They build this incredible relationship, and as they have this wonderful relationship, the shepherd has to go away, but he promises to return. When he does return, he's not the shepherd she thought. He's the incredible king of Israel and marries her. It's a great story, but you really have to work really hard to leave off lots of bits and pieces of the story of the Song of Solomon. But maybe Song of Solomon is the story of Cinderella. I would suggest it's simply a collection of love songs. If you have a Bible, one of the newer translations, if you have an older Bible, it becomes really hard to see. But if you have a newer Bible, you'll notice that there's this footnote that if you click on it, it opens up this and it says that primarily on the basis of gender of the Hebrew pronouns. So if you all just spoke and read Hebrew, you wouldn't need this. But most of us, okay, all of us do not. The male and the female speakers are indicated in the margin of captions by lover and beloved, respectively. The words that are in the plural are marked friends. And so as you go through it, you'll notice that it's this chorus back and forth. As we began going through the Bible, I encourage you to try and tackle each book each week. Next week is going to be a chore. There's 66 chapters in Isaiah. That only leaves you about 10 chapters a day, but good luck. The book of the Song of Solomon was a whole lot easier. I've tried to read it in the evenings and listen to them in the mornings. And I don't know if you've seen the dramatized versions, but you can get a dramatized version that they read. It was so lovely to listen as a woman sings the beloved parts. A man says the lover parts, and there's this chorus that fills in, because I do believe it is this incredible song that's not so much meant to be understood as it is felt. In fact, one of the reasons why music has always been an issue that the church fights about, no, it's not something recent.
It's something that goes clear back as far as you go back. In fact, Isaac Watts in the 17th century, when he introduced hymns, split churches. How dare you sing a hymn? I'm convinced that the problem is music is primarily a heart language. It's felt. It's not always thought. And I can't explain why I like this music or I hate that music. But I do. I would suggest the Song of Solomon is much the same way. It's not so much that we're needing to understand every image, because you're going to struggle. I could go to the Song of Solomon and I could use some of these lines. Oh, Renee, how beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful your eyes, behind your veils are doves. Your lips are like a scarlet ribbon. Your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like halves of a... I don't know what a pomegranate is. All beautiful you are, my darling. There is no flaw in you. You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You've stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine and fragrance, or your perfume than any spice. I'm not sure I'd get away with saying your hair looks like goats. I'm really happy you have all of your teeth. And dear, you look just like a horse. This was written some 3,000 years ago in a radically different culture. But you can't read through it without feeling the passion, the excitement, the love that bears itself out in so many different ways. It's an incredible song. A song that I am going to suggest is pretty hard to outline. This is one man's opinion. You have a hard time trying to figure out where's the courtship, where's the marriage, where's the after marriage. And part of the problem is marriage was so radically different in the 10th century B.C. in Israel. You didn't fall in love. You were assigned a bride. You were expected to figure out a way to love your bride after your parents had chosen your bride. If you know anything about it, they didn't have a ceremony like we do today. The groom would go down and sweep and catch his bride. They'd go off to a tent while everybody stood around the tent. They would consummate the marriage. And then as soon as it was consummated, they would have this week-long celebration. That was a marriage. That was a wedding. And then you were expected to go figure out how to love each other. Today, we want to love each other before we fall in love. And please don't hear that to say that, well, okay, I want to go back to arranged marriages, but I'm not sure my family does. And I doubt that we're going to change it anytime soon. But trying to figure out this flow makes it really hard. So can I learn anything? Is there anything to be taken from the book of Song of Solomon? Well, may I just suggest three thoughts. The first is, it's hard to miss the exclusivity, the single-minded devotion that's found. He will use images like, my lover is mine and I am his. There's this image that's found throughout the book of this garden, that I lock my garden and I only allow my love into the garden. It's kept away from everyone else. You see that in several places. And then there's this reoccurring statement, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. I prefer the New Living Translation because it's a little easier for me to understand. Do not awaken love until the time is right. Solomon understands that the love, the physical aspects of marriage can bring as much joy as any experience you will have, or destroy your life as quickly as any experience you will ever endure. And thus, there's this repeat a couple different times in which Solomon says, be careful, don't awaken the love before it's the right time. We live in a culture that longs to awaken your love at the wrong time. You can't turn on the television. You can't go to the radio. You can't open up a book or a magazine in which we are not constantly bombarded with this attempt to arouse us, to excite us. Long before we're ready. When we don't get married until age 27 for women and 29 for guys, maybe it isn't so bad to wait till you're 30 to read Song of Solomon. But he's going to say, be careful. This isn't something you give away to everybody. This is an exclusive, single-minded attempt. But the second thing that really hit me is, please forgive me for being stereotypical, but I find it interesting that the bride in Song of Solomon struggles with two fears that I think many, if not most, women do. The first is, will my husband love me if I get ugly? As you come to chapter 1, she talks about this. Do not stare at me because I'm dark. What is that? Well, in our society, we think that a suntan looks great. In the 10th century BC, a suntan meant that you were a commoner, a lower stratus person, that it was somebody, you were somebody who had to work in the fields. You could easily be looked down. And she says, don't stare at me. It's not my fault. My brothers are making me do their labor as well. And what is Solomon's response? Well, if I can come back to this, I threw it out that she looks like a horse. Let me see if I can't just give you a little bit of the background. He says, I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. If you go back to the 10th century BC, you'll find out that Egypt was known for their chariots. They were world class in their ability to build chariots. All of their chariots were pulled by stallions. Now imagine a barn full of stallions with one mare in it. All of them are going to want her. And Solomon is saying, you are so beautiful to me. You are more precious. Everybody's going to be fighting over you. But I get you. He is reassuring her that I love the way you look. The second fear is this fear of being rejected, that you're going to leave me. In fact, in chapter 3 and in chapter 5, I would suggest it's a dream in which she awakens and notices her lover's gone. In chapter 3, she goes out into the city and she finds him and she grabs hold of him and she won't let him go. Chapter 5, it goes a little different. She's laying in bed when he knocks at the door and she hesitates just for a second. Then she pops up, but he's gone. He's disappeared. And the reason I would suggest it's a dream is because it ends with the watchman finding her, beating her, bruising her, disrobing her. May I suggest a watchman would never beat and disrobe the queen. It isn't going to go very well for them. And everybody would have known who the queen was. I would suggest it is this fear that she has, you're going to leave me. Guys, may I suggest that the best tool you have in your relationship with your wife are your words. I know that I am not very good at speaking poetically my love for my spouse. My dad, when I was getting married, about the only piece of advice he gave me is he said, son, remember this, men always say what they mean and women rarely do. How was your day, dear? Fine. You know what fine means? I've had better days. I've had worse days. It was fine. How was the food? Fine. That means I've had better food and worse food. What Renee desires, I would suggest what most of our wives desire, is to take that little bit of dangerous step and put yourself out there with words that maybe you wouldn't normally use. Renee and I got engaged on Christmas Eve. I went to India on New Year's Day, came back about a week or two before the wedding. The only real means of communication was letters. I don't know what happened to those letters, but I hope they never resurface ever. There will be no publishing of my memoirs when I get older, okay? It's not going to happen. And yet the way you win your wife's heart is being willing to go out on a limb, praise her. But what is fascinating to me, go home, count the words. Do you know that there are twice as many words spoken by the bride as by the groom? And what I find really fascinating is almost all of the words of Solomon are to his bride. Many of the words of the bride are to those around him. The marriage was obviously very public. In fact, one of the things that will often happen is she will sing his praises to anyone who will listen. While women may fear getting ugly or being rejected, I'm convinced that most of us guys struggle with an inadequacy, that we want others to respect us. Wives, you have an incredible opportunity to build your husband up to anybody who will listen. Now, please leave the whole physical part out. But there is an incredible opportunity to praise him while others are listening. In fact, I would suggest the most damaging thing you will ever do is to cut him down in public. Solomon goes out of his way to help us understand that words really matter. Lastly, I think we need not to be embarrassed by the physical side of love. I say that even though it's been 21 years since I've come here, and this is the first, and if you wait another 21 years, probably the last time I will speak on Song of Solomon on a Sunday morning. It is an embarrassing topic in a mixed group. And yet it is an incredibly important topic. I remember several years ago reading a statement that really kind of hit me. It said that everywhere in our society talks about sex except for the church. Maybe that's why sex has been so polluted in our society, because we're scared to talk about it. I think we as parents have a responsibility to help our kids. I think we as a church have a responsibility to encourage one another that this is one of God's grandest gifts. In fact, I love the way the book ends. It's going to end this way. Speaking the bride is, she says, under the apple tree, I roused you. There your mother conceived you. There she who was in labor gave birth. Place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. For love is as strong as death. Think about that image just for a second. Is there any power more greater than death? She says love is. In fact, jealousy is unyielding as the grave. And then she throws out this. It burns like the blazing fire, like a mighty fire. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot wash it away. If one were to give all the wealth of his house for love, it would be utterly scorned. Fire is one of the most amazing inventions. Your life is transformed by fire. You will, in a few minutes, go home, I'm guessing, to a warm meal that you've cooked because fire exists. You will go and have your house warmed. You'll have your house cooled. Most of the electricity that we enjoy comes from a fire, burning of natural gas or coal. Without fire, you wouldn't be able to drive a car. Your life would be radically different if fire simply disappeared. And yet, I don't remember the last day on the news I didn't hear a story of a forest fire. We went down to Phoenix back at the first part of June for my niece's wedding. We met up with some friends from the town that I grew up in, and he and his wife, they're both retired. They went the long way through Colorado because it was their intention to take one of those steam-powered trains through the mountains to look at the sites. They couldn't because there was a forest fire. And the officials recognize that fire, when uncontrolled, will devastate everything in its way. And even the rushing waves of a river can't stop it. Once it's out of control, you're going to get burned. Your fire in the furnace is an incredible gift on cold winter mornings, but the moment that fire leaps outside the furnace, you're in trouble. I love that imagery. Sex is one of God's greatest gifts to us when contained in the proper place between one man and one woman in a committed marriage relationship. But the moment it gets out of there, watch out. It will destroy anyone it touches. The book of Song of Solomon is an uncomfortable book, but it is an important book. God included it in his scripture for a reason, and I hope we can learn from it. Father, I thank you for the few moments we've had this morning. I thank you for your word, and even when it deals with topics that maybe we don't want to talk about but need to. God, I do pray for every marriage in this room that you would kindle a fire, that they would enjoy the erotic love that you desire for them to have. But I pray for all those who are not married, single, or no longer married, that you would help them understand the dangers of this incredible gift that you give for marriage. Thank you. Bless us now this week, for it's in your Son's holy and precious name we pray. Amen. Thank you so much. Have a great week.